Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Taking the Lead in Sudden Cardiac Arrest Prevention, Options for the At-Risk Patient, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Bruce L. Wilcoff, MD. Dr. Wilcoff is a director, Cardiac Pacing and Tachyarrhythmia Devices, Department of Cardiovascular Medicine. Professor of Medicine, Cleveland Clinic, Lerner College of Medicine of Case Western Reserve University, Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Wilcoff has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Wilcoff does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Wilcoff does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The goal of this activity is to increase awareness of potential complications with lead extraction of devices, enabling physicians to anticipate and implement strategies to avoid sudden cardiac arrest. This activity is supported by Zoll Medical Corporation. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Dr. Bruce Wilcoff, Director of Cardiac Pacing and Tachyarrhythmia Devices at the Cleveland Clinic, and I'm going to be speaking today about sudden death prevention after ICD system extraction. This is going to come down to approximately three questions. First of all, what is CIED, or cardiovascular implantable electronic device infection? How is lead extraction involved? And how should we manage the patient at risk for sudden cardiac arrest with infection? First, lead extraction. Lead extraction is the removal of a lead that has been implanted for more than a year, regardless of the duration of the implant, if it requires assistance of a specialized equipment that is not included with a typical device implant. Leads that are not in that long are just called lead removal and are generally not a difficult thing to remove. Now, if all leads looked like this lead, where, as this cartoon shows, no fibrotic attachments and sort of a very idealistic look at it, this would not be a problem. On the other hand, as you can see on this slide, there are clots that form at every point that the lead touches the endovascular points, and fibrosis develops and gets more severe and even calcifies over time. So it's these clots and fibrosis and calcification that become barriers to lead extraction. Now, there are multiple indications for lead extraction. I'll briefly talk about lead fractures, where the conductors or the insulators become damaged, and when damaged, then the lead doesn't work properly, it has to be removed. At other times, venous occlusion, as you can see on this venogram, where there's bilateral occlusion of the subclavian vein system, that the blood cannot get back except through collaterals. These are two important reasons for transvenous lead extraction, but are not the subject of today's talk. On the other hand, infection, which you can see this vegetation on this open view of this cardiac patient, this vegetation is attached to the leads and indeed is endocarditis, an infection of the endothelial layer of the heart. And in fact, when you see it surgically, you'll note that it's even more severe than you would imagine from even an echocardiographic picture. If we look at the accumulated experience at the Cleveland Clinic between January of 2002 to March 2007, patients who were referred for CIED infections at the Cleveland Clinic, there were 412 patients, average age of 68, and mostly male. This was reported by Taracci and my colleagues in Heart Rhythm in 2010. Now, the clinical presentation of these patients could be either with localized signs and symptoms in 59%, systemic signs and symptoms with an intact pocket in 39%, and in 2% only presented with persistent bacteremia. Unfortunately, there's no particular set of signs or symptoms that happen even in a majority of patients. Erythema only occurred 41%, swelling 38%, tenderness 28%, and you can see drainage and erosion at 38% and 21%. So you have to look for a constellation of findings. No one thing is specific. Even fevers and chills and malaise do not occur in as much as half the patients. Now, if you do present with a systemic sign or symptoms, you will likely have a positive blood culture. In this particular study, 91% of the people had a positive blood cultures. But even in these circumstances, 9% of the patients did not have a positive blood culture. On the other hand, a minority of patients who presented with localized signs and symptoms, that's mostly with something in the pocket, redness, swelling, or drainage, those patients, 81%, did not have a positive culture, with 19% having a systemic blood culture positive. It turns out that infections of implantable devices are an issue of staphylococcal infection. And this is because of the biofilm, the biology of the bacteria. It produces this sticky film that makes it very difficult for the body to fight off infections next to plastic or metal. And you can see that it's fairly evenly distributed between resistant and sensitive Staph aureus and Staph epidermidis, that is sensitive or resistant to methicillin. Now, when it comes to reimplanting after we've taken everything out, it turns out that there is no reimplantation that occurred in about a third of the patients in the patients seen in this cohort at the Cleveland Clinic. 59% were reimplanted, but the management of these patients that we did not reimplant or we transferred to another facility is important. And what do we do with those patients, especially if they had an implantable defibrillator as their device, and especially if they're at continued risk for sudden cardiac arrest? On the other hand, we do not want to reimplant too quickly. Among the 235 patients who got reimplanted during that same hospital stay, over the first year of follow-up, six of those patients, or 2.5%, presented with infections. Five of these patients had systemic symptoms and positive blood cultures as original presentation. So reimplantation too early is really not productive. In May of 2009, at the Heart Rhythm Society meeting in Boston, we had a consensus satellite symposium, and subsequently in July published our findings of transvenous lead extraction, an expert consensus on facilities, training, indications, and patient management. And this is sort of the state-of-the-art recommendations for how to go about doing lead extraction. If a center commits to doing transvenous lead extraction, the very first principle is a commitment to quality. A commitment to quality because this is an invasive procedure, and it's potentially a dangerous procedure in overcoming that fibrosis without tearing the vein or the heart, causing any serious life-threatening problems. In order to do the commit to quality, you also have to measure your outcomes. Now, this goes all the way from the device implantation, where you have to measure your infection rates and your other lead failure rates, but also we're going to talk about outcomes of your transvenous lead extraction. When you're thinking about transvenous lead extraction or thinking about CIED infections, you need to take a long-term perspective. You're not just trying to get through the procedure. What you're trying to do is to do the best thing for that patient over a period of time. And you have to consider that this patient's going to potentially live for another 5, 10 or 15 years. And I like to think in the 10-year time period to work on this, because I want to do the best thing not for that patient for today, but the best thing for the next 10 years for this patient. And our goal is to reduce morbidity. We're looking at all the morbidity, we're talking about shocks, we're talking about infection, we're talking about keeping them alive, obviously. So we're trying to think this ahead. And defibrillators, if nothing else, are a strategic therapy. They're a strategy to keep a person alive. On the other hand, it also needs to be with as little morbidity as possible. Now, while it's possible to have significant dangerous problems that occur during a transvenous lead extraction. I've put up here the experience at the Cleveland Clinic from 2001 through 2007. And our experience goes back to the late 80s and continues to the present at about the same rate. You can see that we do about 300 or so extraction procedures with about 540 leads extracted per year. And our clinical success rate is well over 99% with major complications, meaning internal bleeding or death, at 0.33%. So let's say it's less than a half a percent at an experienced center. Having a low complication rate and keeping track of that is an important part of making a decision how to manage these patients. We looked at the Cleveland Clinic and 12 other centers, as Wozni reported in the Journal of American College of Cardiology, the Lexicon study. The Lexicon study was looking at 13 experienced extraction centers, and we looked not just in section, but at all reasons for extraction. You can see on the slide that infection was attributed as the indication in about 57% of the patients. And so it's still a majority of the extractions, but not all the extractions. But this gives us some insight as to what happens to those patients. On this next slide, we can see that there are certain things that are different between the patients who had DRE, which is device-related endocarditis, and those who had extractions for non-device-related endocarditis reasons. That includes pocket infections, but we just divided into those two different groups. And you can see, despite the fact that the patients had a lower ejection fraction in the non-device-related endocarditis, they also had a higher mortality in the endocarditis population. Now, they did have more diabetes, and they had more renal insufficiency. I mean, this is not even renal failure. This is just a creatinine over 2. But you can see that about a quarter of these patients had renal insufficiency. Now, the major adverse events during the procedure were about 1.5% between the two groups, not very much difference. But the hospital death rates were much different between these groups. And it's important because you want to treat a patient when they don't have an infection at all. In fact, the hospital mortality overall was 1.86%, but it was very segregated. If there was no infection, the hospital mortality was 0.3%. Remember, I said that major complication rate was 0.3% as well. So basically, if they could get through the procedure and they didn't have an infection, they did very, very well. But just having a pocket infection, meaning they just had swelling at their pocket or a drainage, then they had a hospital mortality of 1.7% even without endocarditis. And if they had device-related endocarditis, it went up to 4.3%. So you can see that you would rather never get an infection. You're looking to prevent these things. But even a pocket infection has a mortality risk associated with it. But you certainly want to treat it before the patient develops endocarditis. Now, once we remove the device and the leads, and we debride entirely the device pocket and close the pocket, and we start the patient on antibiotics, we still have to figure out what we're going to do with this patient who had a need for an implantable defibrillator. Now, we're talking about people that maybe secondary prevention already had a sudden cardiac arrest, or we're looking for people who have not had one yet, but are at risk for a SCD-HF patient, a MATED2 patient, something like that. Or perhaps a patient like a companion patient, a patient who has a CRT. So if we're going to reimplant, each patient should be carefully evaluated to determine if there's a continued need for the new device. The replacement device should not be on the same side to the extraction site. So if we took it out of the left side, we have to put it on the right side. Or if both shoulders have been involved, perhaps we'll put it in through the iliac vein, or we'll go transatrial, or we'll even do an open chest procedure. But the point is, it's not done at the same procedure, and it's not done at the same spot. And there's a period of time between which you take out the device, you start them on antibiotics, and then you put in the new device. Now, a new CIED system can be implanted into patients when there is no further clinical evidence a systemic infection, and the blood cultures drawn within 24 hours of the device removal remain negative for at least another 72 hours. So 3 days, at least 3 days. But there has to be no valvular or lead-associated vegetations, but had preoperative positive blood cultures, or positive lead tip cultures, or preoperative sepsis and positive blood cultures. But it is reasonable to delay that transvenous reimplantation of the new device into patients who have the valvular or lead-associated vegetations for at least 14 days, meaning that there's a group of patients that you can reimplant fairly early if the positive blood cultures are now negative. They're negative for 72 hours, fine. You can reimplant in a few days. You just monitor them for a few days. But if there are vegetations, ongoing cellulitis, ongoing fevers, reasons to think that there's systemic involvement, then you're going to wait for at least 14 days, and sometimes you should wait longer. So when we're doing this, we have to plan ahead. The timing of the reimplantation, we have to think from before we take it out to when we're going to put it back in. We have to consider the entire care pathway. We have to think about things about pacemaker dependency, what their risk, their indication was for the implantable defibrillator. You know, if you can't reimplant, if there are reasons that the patient has medical conditions that would prevent this from happening, you should consider as a possibility chronic suppression. Not every patient should get the extraction done, but that is essentially saying that you're palliating the situation and the patient is going to die from their infection and stay on antibiotics for the rest of their life. You may consider saying no. It may be in a patient who doesn't have options for putting another BIV in and who's essentially staying alive on their BIV but now has an infection. Taking out that BIV might be as risky just because of the loss of BIV pacing. So saying no is a possibility. Sometimes the patient doesn't need another device. The patient may have had an indication for a defibrillator or a pacemaker when they first had it implanted, but either because it was viewed improperly or because the situation has changed, they may not have a current indication, in which case you would not reimplant. Primary prevention defibrillators are different than secondary prevention, especially if they've not had an event yet. Waiting a little while without a device is not such a big deal in somebody that's never had an event. It's a long-term strategy. The defibrillators are long-term strategies to prevent death. On the other hand, secondary prevention defibrillator patients have more frequent episodes, at least 3 or 4 times higher rate of events than primary prevention patients. And these patients have known risk because they've already had an event before. You would be more concerned about taking out a device and not protecting the patient on a secondary prevention situation. Patients who are pacemaker dependent provide a very special different problem because they have to have at least a temporary pacemaker and will need to stay in the hospital until you can put the new device in. Most of these patients do not have to stay in the hospital a long time. And, of course, you have to consider the CRT indications. How are you going to put the left ventricular lead on? Are you going to put it in transvenously, epicardially? You have to think of through all of those situations. Now, for that group of patients who are going to go an extended period of time without an implantable defibrillator because you don't want them to get another infection but are at risk for sudden cardiac arrest, we have to find ways of protecting those patients. And I think a wearable cardioverter defibrillator is a very reasonable consideration. We use quite a number of these at the Cleveland Clinic. Chung and her colleagues at the Cleveland Clinic reviewed the wearable cardioverter defibrillator situation in 3,569 patients. For these patients, many of these patients, 59, had 80 VT or VF events, all of which were converted. Now, not everybody did well. Some patients had asystole, and that's why you have to know that whether a patient's at risk for bradycardia. But seeing that these defibrillators actually do the job and they can save the patients can go out of the hospital, get their infection treated for their 2, 4, or even 6 weeks of IV antibiotics with device endocarditis is really important. when we look at the statistics, we see that approximately 23% of these patients had their wearable defibrillator for defibrillator explants because of infections usually. And they wore those wearable defibrillators for about 2 months, 56 days on average. And there were 49 events in 33 patients. It shows you that it's a very effective therapy for these patients. You can see that the patients, although it's a bit inconvenient, put up with it because it's a limited period of time. And I don't want to say that it's a negative thing. I mean, these patients are nervous about leaving the hospital being unprotected. So they really want to be wearing it. And you can see in this slide that these patients had a very high compliance, over 20 hours per day on average for up to 2 months. And you can see that these patients used their defibrillator for quite a long time. So depending on your situation, a pocket infection, likely you're going to be able to reimplant within just a few days. You're not going to need a wearable defibrillator or even to discharge the patient before they finish their therapy and get their new device. But if there's device-related endocarditis and vegetations, you're going to want to go a longer period of time. An alternative to prolonged therapy is to have their extraction done with surgery and then debride all the endocarditis and vegetations. On the other hand, a majority of the time, you can get away with taking it out transvenously, have less morbidity that way, and then use a wearable defibrillator in the interim. You have to be careful. Sometimes patients will have a PFO with a right-to-left shunt, and if they have vegetations, you may very much want to take them to surgery to both close the PFO or to debride those vegetations. So you may not need you have to think of the whole situation, the PFO, bradycardia, whether they're morbidly obese, whether they've had prior chest surgery, all of these things make a difference. Unfortunately, Medicaid provides a special problem with the wearable defibrillators, and so reimbursement for these devices may not be available for all patients, but Medicare does pay for it, most insurers do pay for it, and I think this is a great option for these patients. Intermediate care facilities may be another way to obviate the need for a wearable defibrillator if they can be monitored for a period of time and then brought back for the defibrillator implantation. So I want to thank you for listening to me over the last few minutes about sudden death prevention after ICD system extraction. I hope you treat implantable device infections very seriously and that you have a strategy in mind when you see patients with this important problem. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Taking the Lead in Sudden Cardiac Arrest Prevention, Options for the At-Risk Patient. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.